Chapter 31. Primary Fellowship, again. June 1970. It's not about how bad you want it. It's about how hard you are willing to work for it. Anonymous. It was now mid-April. The daffodils and crocuses peeking through the warming soil in Regent's Park, presaging spring, a new life, a new beginning. Our booking on the QE2 across the Atlantic to New York heralded a new start for me, but particularly gave me another chance to become fully absorbed and engaged with the woman I had married. And Cunard's brochures showed passengers lounging on the deck, sunning themselves. We would depart for Boston at the end of June 1970. I had to pass the primary fellowship in surgery to redeem myself as a human being, free myself from self-loathing, and enhance my status across the pond. Having failed in my first attempt and accumulating some financial reserves working for Esso, I signed up at the Royal College of Surgeons in Lincoln's Inn Fields to attend the several-week preparatory courses. The primary would be given in early June. I was embarking on a study marathon with potentially gratifying rewards. Embarking on a surgical career, reaffirming my love for Victoria, and rewarding us with a leisurely romantic holiday cruise. Truthfully, the prospect of starting life over in Boston and the end of life with the temptations of Hannah. The lectures were scheduled 3 times a week in the late afternoon. They covered anatomy, physiology, and some pathology to a greater depth than we had studied in medical school, with an emphasis on practical knowledge and its application to patients. In anatomy, the structure related to function, lectures were given by the sage R.J. Last, Professor of Applied Anatomy. This elderly anatomist would gently walk on the stage, pick up some chalk, and draw a horizontal line on the blackboard.
"What is this?"
The 36 students, who sat riveted on the lecture benches, yelled out various answers. He'd smile and say,
"It's the base of the maxillary sinus," pointing to his face.
We immediately knew the topic he was teaching, the anatomy of the head and neck. Proceeding from there, he'd draw additional lines, and gradually, over the 2 hours, build up layer after layer of a three-dimensional view of the head, with muscles, nerves, and glands, continuing with the deep muscles of the neck, including the salivary and lymph glands, would be created, all the while challenging his audience in a way that became a two-way conversation, funny, engaging, yet serious. In another lecture covering sphincters, his question was simple.
"What muscles do you use when pulling a rope?"
The students shouted out several answers. He smiled.
"The most important are the laryngeal muscles in your throat and your anal muscles. Otherwise, you'd dump in your pants."
We cheered. We got the point. We learned the lesson. How could one forget the information he elegantly imparted and so cleverly taught? In contrast, the tall, portly, sagacious D. Sloan, Professor of Applied Physiology, would strut onto the stage and enthusiastically engage us, teaching the basic concepts of physiology, embryology, and the biochemical processes that apply to organs such as the liver. When it came to the diaphragm, he reminded us that during fetal development, it descended from the developing back muscles, and to emphasize the point, he dropped his spread handkerchief like a parachute. His lectures were permeated with such wisdom and witticisms that the audience became thoroughly engaged in his teachings, and the material was enjoyable to learn. Both professors were charming elderly showmen, skillful communicators and orators, stimulating their students. Neither one used slides or other visual aids. The 2-hour lectures were a delight to attend. Not only did I learn the subjects effortlessly, but they became integrated into my surgical being. Toward the end of the course, a young pathologist covered the most common diseases a surgeon was likely to encounter and the scientific basis for their treatment. The presentations were dry, earning the title "The Science of Suffering," where the students joked that we were the sufferers.
I knew that I was among the fortunate and privileged few who had insiders teaching and instructing us, and was grateful that I could afford them. They gave me the direction and drive that encouraged me to maintain the discipline of study. After each lecture, I'd walk home singing and in good spirits, my head abuzz with surgically related matters. Perhaps this time I might be among the lucky 20% to earn a passing grade. Victoria was approaching the end of her second internship and was seldom at home. Gradually, I took over the flat, which began to resemble the cluttered rooms of my pre-A-level exam in Manchester and my tomb in Commonwealth Hall in the weeks before second MB, notes and lists stuck on the mantel, pinned to the curtains and the bathroom mirror, lists in need of memorization and topics essential to study. Victoria was tolerant of the flat's transformation in support of my likely success. During the last week, the material covered some exam subjects we might encounter, giving me a peek through a partially open door. Our lecturers had probably figured this out from the list of invited examiners and their known interests. Although I took note of these pointers, I was not a betting man and diligently learned everything, instilling a new confidence within me. I left the course with a feeling of optimism and excitement. I felt thoroughly prepared and confident, yet the fear of failure lingered, my father's branding mark, and my earlier sabotage of my own success. Early in June, wearing a dark grey suit bought from Moss Brothers using my ash cash, I walked briskly from Albany Street to the narrow back street basement entrance of the examination hall. I noted that the location of the ventilation vent, where 10 men had previously left their mark of anger and disappointment, was shielded. Mr. Arthur Palmer once more directed me to a murmur-filled hall with examination desks. I took a seat among my fellow candidates. Face down in front of me lay an anatomy question sheet with a blank examination booklet for my answers. At 10 a.m. we were instructed to turn over the white sheet. The first question made me smile. Describe the anatomy, relations, and blood supply of the left ureter. What a great question. This was the structure I had drawn on Victoria's abdomen some years ago. Was this a propitious omen? Several other questions followed, which I answered, finishing in time. After the lunch break, I faced the second written examination on applied physiology. Tired yet relaxed, I walked home in the late afternoon. I felt I had done well. Victoria, who had completed her internship, took the last 2 weeks of June off as holiday. She was home and met me with a cup of tea. To remain in the present and to not disturb my equilibrium, I had asked her to keep our surroundings unchanged until I had the results. She had not attempted to gather up the books, my papers, or tidy up the notes that draped our breakfast table. Instead, she was busy packing two huge trunks in preparation for our sea voyage to New York. "How was it?" she asked hesitantly. "Interestingly, not as traumatic as the first time. I was able to answer all the questions, thanks to the surgical courses," I replied. "But the tough exam, the viva voce, is the next hurdle." "You'll do all right, I'm sure." Exhausted, I fell into a deep sleep, snuggling with my wife in our cozy double bed. 2 days later, I entered the back of the examination hall by the basement door once more, where I was met by Mr. Palmer, asking for my candidate number. 24. At my last try, Mr. Palmer seemed a man to be feared. Now he seemed quite amiable. He was small and well-dressed, with keen insight into the stressed candidates and self-important judges who were surgeons. His skill of organizing the candidates for the orals was renowned. He gathered us into groups of 12 and reviewed the procedures. "When your number is called, go to your assigned cubicle. Each of the two examiners will question you for 15 minutes. I will ring a bell, and you will move to the next cubicle. Should you, perchance, know the professor, excuse yourself and come see me. You will see another two groups in the afternoon."
To reassure the candidates, he explained that the oral examiners were not those who had read our written answers and had no clue how well we had done. At 10 a.m. the bell rang, and the first 12 candidates were directed by Mr. Palmer into their cubicles. A calm 30 minutes later, our group filed toward the front of the firing line. Sitting down, I was asked my number, and after a polite greeting, I faced my first question. What is a sphincter? It's an area of high pressure surrounding a cylindrical structure such as the orbicularis oris, the larynges, the esophagus, the anal sphincter, controlled by slings of muscles. Would you consider the pylorus in the duodenum a sphincter? He retorted. Indeed. And how would you describe its function? I was fully in the present and totally engaged by his question and the numerous others that followed. His partner took over and fired his questions at me. My responses were cogent and in-depth. Unaware of the passing of time, when the bell rang, I was reluctant to leave. I was enjoying facing the challenges thrown at me and sharing the information I had acquired. I moved to the next cubicle, feeling in high spirits, like a boxer eager to step into another ring. The whole process was repeated when I faced a different pair of professors and a different set of anatomy questions. By late morning, I faced the physiology viva voce. Once more, I felt confident and answered convincingly. The questions given to me ranged from cardiac output to the amount of bile the liver produces after receiving one unit of whole blood. I knew the answers. Generally, when a candidate had done well or was borderline and there were a few minutes left in the interrogation, the professors might challenge him, either to determine the limits of the candidate's knowledge or perhaps to throw a life buoy question. So I was caught off guard when I was next asked, "What do you think causes birth defects in infants born with shortened limbs?" I interpreted the question to mean that I must be a borderline candidate, and I wanted to yell, "No, no, please ask me a surgically relevant one. Give me another chance. I have a few minutes left." Panic welled up from deep within me. Sensing my hesitation and perhaps my alarm, he suggested several probabilities, to which I answered monosyllabically. The bell rang. With that, I left, now uncertain of my performance. Per Mr. Palmer's instructions, at around 4 p.m. we crowded into a stuffy, windowless room and sat in various states of anxiety, pondering our fate. Had I just wasted 6 months of study, or had I made the grade? 15 minutes later, Mr. Palmer appeared at the door, list in hand. Silence fell upon the wretched crowd of would-be surgeons. In a deep baritone voice, he declared, "I will read out the number of only successful candidates. Please step forward. I will ask you if you are Dr. So-and-so, and when you acknowledge your name, I will tell you, 'Congratulations, Mr. So-and-so,' indicating as you step through the door that you are on your way to becoming a surgeon." Raising his paper, he read the first number. "Candidate number 3. There were moans and a yelp of joy as the successful doctor rose and approached Mr. Palmer. And so it went down the line, the announced numbers approaching closer and closer to the 20s. My heart started to race, and my grey suit became a tightly fitting sweatsuit. My body perspired profusely. I could hardly breathe as Mr. Palmer voiced, "Numbers 19, 20, 21. The run of successful candidates preceding my number surely meant that the next few numbers were those of failed candidates to obey the law of averages. Mr. Palmer shuffled his papers and continued, "Number 24, 25. The immense relief I felt hearing that I had passed nearly led to a meltdown. I rose on wobbly legs, gathered myself together, and numbly strode to the front door. "Dr. McGeed?" "Yes." "Congratulations, Mr. McGeed." And with a wave of his hand, he ushered me out into the cool day, now a reborn man.
I started to run down the street through the light rain when a taxi appeared in the middle of the one-way road. I hailed it, aware that another man on the opposite pavement had hailed it too. The taxi stopped in the middle of the street. I ran for it and opened the door at the same time as the other man. I got in first, so technically it was mine. As I looked across the cab, I recognized one of my examiners. I graciously relented and exited. The taxi took off, leaving me standing in the rain. Resuming my trot toward Albany Street, I realized the drops running down my face were a mixture of heaven's rain and my tears of joy, for I had achieved my first goal to become a surgeon. But they were also the shedding of tears of self-pity and anger at the persistent shadow of my dead father, the man who was never satisfied by what I had achieved as a child and who had been perpetually disappointed in me during the few years we had together. They were tears of contrition for my selfish behavior, for the pain I had inflicted on Hannah, tears for the pain I would have caused Victoria, and tears for the relief of overcoming my pain of abandonment and the joy of finally having passed. Continuing my dash home to Victoria, and in a hoarse voice, I yelled out repeatedly, "I did it! I passed! I passed!" Passers-by in Gower and Euston Streets must have thought I was an escaped mental case, and, in a way, I was. I had done it, despite my parents, or maybe because of them. I was standing on the initial rung of the ladder to mastering the scalpel in earnest and becoming a surgeon. Nothing would stop me now. And in the doorway stood Victoria.
"Did you fail?"
"Passed," I said, hugging her. "One of only 20%.
"Then why are you crying?"
I did not answer. I had many reasons to weep.